Hello and welcome to episode 134 of The Creighton Crowbar. It is the 22nd of March 2016. My name is Chris Thurston and today I'm joined by Tom Francis.
Hello.
And Alex Wiltshire.
Hello.
Special guest Alex Wiltshire.
Special guest.
Special guest. When you were last on the podcast, you were at Hello Games, I think.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
And then you are also formerly of Edge. You're a writer for RPS and other places.
That's right.
What are you up to now, Alex?
Most of the time I work for a little studio called Sensible Object, where we're making a digital physical game called Fabulous Beasts for iOS and that kind of thing. But I also write and that sort of thing. So I'm writing a book at the moment. So I do this and that.
This and that, man.
What's your book about?
Can't tell you.
Ah.
Secrets.
A secret book, man. Is it about computer games?
It's about a computer game, yeah.
Gosh. What could that possibly mean? I will find out, I imagine, in the future. Tom.
Yes.
You look tired.
I am.
Why?
I feel all right now, but I just got back from GDC, which my new friend who I met out there, Harrison Pink, described as social crunch.
So that's a very game developer way of putting that. Yeah. I'm assuming that your new friend is a game developer because of the game developer conference.
He works on Mafia 3.
Ah.
It was good. It was like
they've announced
10
Mafia 3, right?
Days. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's a whole trade off about it.
We can, if what you've just heard is a series of bleeps, they were good bleeps.
Can you also bleep out me saying there's a whole trailer about it? So it's like a bunch of talks and then a bunch of social events in the evening, which is the social crunch part. But then also just between the talks, you run into a million people you know because there are, I think, 27,000 game developers there for the week.
Jesus.
It's a complete clusterfuck.
Is that what the C stands for?
Yeah. Game developer clusterfuck. This year it was kind of swamped with VR stuff, but I managed to not see any of it. I neither saw any of the talks about VR nor had any VR demos, partly just because they kind of clashed with most things. I didn't end up doing a lot of like show floor stuff. I was mostly going to talks. My laptop broke 4 times, so I spent a lot of time in the Apple shop, which meant I missed some talks. At 10 a.m. on Monday, I had 6 different talks simultaneously that I wanted to see. And one of them, the one I actually decided to go to, was cancelled, which is a Kerbal Space Program one. And the room that it was supposed to be in, which I entered, turned out to be a completely different talk that was not among the 6 I wanted to see, so I missed all 6. But I did see some good stuff. My favourite talk, I think, was the AI disaster stories session, which is,
yeah.
I always go and see stuff on the AI track because it's one of the technical fields where you can understand a lot of it, or, you know, when it fucks up, at least it's funny. It's just kind of like esoteric. It felt like you don't get that information anywhere else. Like, there's loads of people talking about design, loads of blog posts about that, and there are about AI too, but they're written for AI designers, whereas AI programmers, whereas these talks are kind of sometimes more accessible. And the AI disaster stories was a series of different AI programmers all talking about challenges they'd had. Some of them just sort of told a story of like a thing that they, oh, we had this problem, then we solved it. That was it. And then some of them said, we had this problem, we never solved it. But the one that had the correct balance of actual problem and somewhat being solved was somebody Carlson, whose first name I forget, but I'll put it in the show notes, who told a story. He used to work on Battlefield 2 doing the bots. And he was tasked with making a presentation to show how good the bot AI was, and he just recently taught them how to play medic. So the medic in Battlefield 2 has defibrillators and they can resurrect dead people as long as they haven't respawned yet. And so he thought that would be a good demo of the bot's abilities, if they could actually like successfully detect a dead person, run over to it and resurrect it. So he spawned 10 of them. Not quite sure why he spawned 10, but he had friendly fire on, so he shot one of them. And then the remaining 9 all immediately notice the corpse, run to it, and try and resurrect it. But the defibrillators take a while to charge up. Like, when you press fire, your guy says, stand clear! And then the defibrillators go, boom! And by the time he said the word stand, the next 3 medics have also said, stand! And they've all started charging their defibrillators. And so at the moment that his fire, it resurrects the guy correctly, But then immediately afterwards, he gets hit by the next person's defibrillators, which kills him. And immediately afterwards, he gets hit by the third medic's defibrillators, which resurrects him. And then the fourth kills him. And then the fifth resurrects him. And the sixth kills him. And they're clustered so tightly that, like, some of the medics can't even get to the body, but they're all desperately trying to, like, barge past each other to resurrect or kill him. And because he's they're also on a slope, each time he ragdolls, he slides, like, a little bit further down the slope. And so he's just created this ball of medics just going, stand clear, stand clear, stand clear, stand clear, where one's constantly being killed and resurrected endlessly, like, rolling down a hill.
That sounds like also like a clusterfuck.
Yes.
Have you been to GDC, Alex?
I have, quite a few times, yeah.
Excellent. Are you having some microphone problems there?
Yeah, it's slowly moving further and further down. I think I've corrected it now, but I don't know what's happened. Anyway,
one of them does that. It happened to me last week.
I'm just going to slowly shift down in my seat, so I'm always at the optimum height.
I wonder if listeners can tell that one of us is at any given time sliding slowly deeper and deeper into themselves.
GDC is, like, it's amazing. Like, as you go up the escalators that go up to the different floors of the convention center, like, it's just streams of developers, and, like, they're
going
just
up like salmon going up river.
It is, yeah. And it's graceful
to mate and die.
Yeah. But, like, you get like all of the flavors. So you get the indie flavor. Like, so you get, like, ones. I remember one year there was this guy that I kept seeing that had multiple hats on. He had, like, several different trilbies, like, bouncing on top of each other.
Not like when people say, "I've got one wearing several different hats." Like, I have several different roles. I don't know, wearing several hats.
Yes, yeah, well, not even
that was his only role, ironically.
But then you get, like, sort of total bog standard developers who, like, who like ascribe to every single kind of stereotype you can imagine. So, like, yeah, no, it is amazing though. Like, the talks can be terrible, but are often, like, I remember one, and the AI ones are, like, I remember one for the AI of what's the name in BioShock Infinite. About how
splicers, big daddies.
About the companion, the lady.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking previous BioShocks. Elizabeth,
yeah, and that was, like, super interesting. Just, and it's all about the errors of the best.
Yeah. Did they program her to just constantly say, "Here, Booker, catch," and throw coins at you? It's weird because I almost feel like I don't appreciate good companion AI. Like, the best it can do is get out of my way. And it's impressive that it's able to, but that's sort of it. I don't remember any moments with Elizabeth or Alex, really. I mean, Alex, there were lots of kind of animation things that would make you react emotionally, but I never sort of, at least none of the things that affected me did I ascribe to AI, which maybe is the goal of AI.
Exactly. Yeah, like, so with Elizabeth, like, it was all about making her remain on screen, like, depending on no matter where you were, that you were aware that she was with you, so,
so she just sort of edge
to
into the camera. Yeah. I'm still here.
But then she'd appear busy as well, like, so do sort of reasonably believable, yeah, things, kind of doing busy work, like, in front in view. But then also when you're running forward, like, you want, they wanted her on screen running just ahead of you, it's like, sort of to the side, one side or the other. But of course, like, the game doesn't know where you're going to run. So a lot of the AI is basically trying to figure out where on earth you're going to make sure that Elizabeth is kind of prefiguring it. Like, it's just like all of AI seems to be factoring in for stuff that makes you not notice it.
Yeah. There's a good bit of the AI talks about, it was about Google self-driving cars, but using them as kind of like a inspiration for what you can do with AI, because Google self-driving cars had a problem where people couldn't tell whether they were going to go or not at an intersection, you know, because they don't have roundabouts in America, so they just all just hope that someone will go first and that they'll figure it out. But robots can't hope, so
robots can't hope.
So the problem was that it was just precise and sort of robotic about its how it behaved. So if it wasn't going to go, it didn't move at all, and then when it did go, it would just move all at once. And that's not how humans behave. And humans instinctively, maybe without even realizing it, look for cues from other people. So at an intersection, you see someone creeping ahead, you know they want to go. Yeah. But if they see you go, they're going to stop. And so that's how you take your cues. But they found, like, people would just sort of wait for it to go at intersections or not know where it was going. And even just people crossing the road in front of it, like, it would stop to let them go. But and then they wouldn't cross because they weren't sure if it was going. And then it would just wait there. and they were just getting like a deadlock with it. Well, why is it stopping now? Because it can see I can't go, I'm not going. So why isn't it just going past me? Is it waiting for me to cross the road? Then it's going to kill me.
You can't make eye contact with a self-driving car, can you?
Yeah, exactly.
You need the apologetic face.
Oh, sorry.
I was thinking as they were saying this, oh, they, yeah, they need some kind of like external signaling mechanism on the outside, like a little light.
I promise I won't kill you.
not to reassure civilians, but at intersections to indicate like, oh, you know, I'm going in 3, 2, 1 or whatever. But actually the solution was to just use the existing things they already have access to in the car, which is just moving, and just do it the way humans do it, which is it will now intentionally creep forward, you know, in a way that you shouldn't really do. Like, you're not supposed to go out into an intersection until you're ready to go. And they're using it as an example of how you, an AI programmer, can put life and character into NPCs without having to trouble an animator to make a custom animation, because the Google car didn't have to sort of, you know, do a big hand wave or anything. It just used its wheels and its existing AI just to kind of show intent by moving a little bit.
Threateningly so creeping forward.
Yeah, exactly. To threaten humans. In fact, that's the example they used. It was Dave Mark was the programmer giving us talk, and he said the game equivalent, he said, would be to have like, as an AI programmer, you can control where an NPC moves and where they look, because you can, you know, you just tell an NPC where to look and the animation is kind of automatic at that point. They can rotate, the character's head. So you can have, for example, when the player walks into like a town square, if one of the characters does a double take at him and then like backs away slowly, then that has loads of, you know, emotional connotations and signals, behavior and a mental state, without you having to ask the animator for a reaction where the NPC looks surprised and scared of the player.
That's super cool. Did you go to any cool parties?
I did. I went to something every night and somehow survived. Like the first night, I went to a party held by my friends at Asymmetric, who do Kingdom of Loathing, and that's always a good one. And there wasn't even any music or anything, but there's just enough people that I completely lost my voice on like the 0th day of JTDC before anything started at all, and was kind of ruined the next morning. But then after that, you've got to like pace yourself, kind of. Like most nights, I went to bed about midnight, and you've got to manage your social crunch, I think. But yeah, that stuff is great because it's, you just get to meet loads of new people. I meet so many people who I either already knew but hadn't met, and some people I didn't know at all. And actually one of the guys I met, was a guy called Gabe, who's developing a game called Ape Out, which is, shit, I hope I got that right. Because there's two ape-related phrases, and I
sure go ape.
It could be go ape. Shit, is it go ape or ape out? I'll correct this in the show notes. I think you might be right. It's go ape.
Because ape out isn't a phrase. So
yeah, I was thinking. Yeah, have I ever aped out?
Shit. I just make up an ape phrase and then name it after that.
That's just coming up with a name. That's not.
All I remember is the ape part of the name, because you play a gorilla in it, and that's the type of ape, right?
Yeah, it's not a monkey.
It's top down. You are like, the art style is such that you are just glowing orange, like textureless and kind of almost abstract. And you just burst out of a cage, and then it's like Hotline Miami, but all you have is your arms. And so you just grab people and just throw them into the wall. And every time you throw them into the wall, like there's a cymbal clash and the screen shakes and everything, and they kind of explode in blood. But you can also like grab people and use them as human shields, like hold onto them for a while and then decide who to throw them at, throw them into each other. If they've got like explosives strapped to them, then you can use them as like basically a rocket launcher. If they've got a gun, you can actually, if they've got a flamethrower, sorry, they can't turn it off. So if you grab them from behind, then you can use them as a flamethrower and run around like chasing all their friends with the flame. And yeah, it's just really satisfying and kind of juicy and violent. And at the end of, I think this is only at the end of the second level, but I kind of thought it was how all the levels end. You could, most of it's like you're going through this randomly generated series of rooms and corridors and stuff, and then right at the end, once it kind of once you complete all that, you're just in one long completely straight corridor with like 30 enemies, and you can still just about get the jump on them if you move fast enough, but it's just like pick up this guy, throw him against the wall, smash this guy in the face, throw this guy at that guy, flame these guys. And it's just like the scene in Old Boy with the corridor and the hammer, but with an ape.
And therefore better.
Mm.
Do you play anything else at school?
Yes. There
was a picture of you with holding a gun to your head.
Oh, yeah. I shot myself with a light gun. the NES Zapper, is it called?
Yeah.
The light gun that came with the NES. There was a bunch of stuff at... this was at that party, which is the name of a party. And there was, for some reason, loads of NES games. Is it NES or SNES that had that light gun?
That was a NES thing. NES,
yeah.
Right. I missed that whole series of consoles, so I don't recognize them by sight. But yeah, one of them was just Russian roulette with a light gun, and you play against an NPC and however many real people you like, and you just have to pass it around the table. You press a button to spin it, to spin the barrel, a sort of hypothetical barrel.
Are these original games, or are these kind of like newly developed ones?
So by original, I thought you meant newly developed. They're newly developed.
Oh, yeah, that word that means both things.
recently made indie games for the NES, I guess. I don't know how it works. I guess it's emulators.
Yeah.
But with your like original peripherals. And yeah, it's just Russian roulette. And like, if you happen to get the bullet in the chamber, then you die and you're out. And if you don't, then you survive. But the NPC won in our case. We both shot ourselves after a great deal of time. You can also like shoot the NPC's beer for some reason. And I'm not sure if that's supposed to counter your turn or not, but it seems like cheating.
Yeah, that is not how Russian roulette is traditionally played. You may shoot yourself or you may shoot my beer.
Damn it, he found the loophole. There's a bunch of cool stuff at the Alt Control GDC part, which is where the kind of exhibit just for alternative control mechanisms. And
so we had our game, Fabulous Pizza, as well.
I saw it but didn't play it. Yeah. Or maybe you should explain how your game is controlled.
Well, first, thanks for bothering to play my game, Tom.
I knew I could play it any time at home.
So it's like it's a game you play on your tabletop and on a screen at the same time. So you have a base on which you balance these animal-shaped pieces. And the object is to both build the kind of like the best and the tallest tower you can of these animals without them falling down. But also, as you stack them onto the platform and on your desktop, the platform senses what each of these pieces are, and you see them pop up on the screen. And as you do that, you see these animals sort of starting to kind of pop into this world on the screen, and you're kind of making tactical decisions about kind of how you're how you're getting all these animals to coexist, and you're feeding them with resources so that they score lots of points, and while also trying to make a really strong tower that doesn't fall down because it's game over and there's towers. So it's like trying to do something where the real world thing is as interesting as the kind of digital thing.
Cool. Yeah, I think it was next to Planet Licker at Alt Control GDC, which is a game that you control by licking, I guess, ice lollies that are built into a controller. I was relieved to find I couldn't play it because the ice things had melted too much and it was no longer working by the time I got there. This is like last thing on Friday.
I'm just going to go out there and say that's a foreseeable technique.
Yeah, who would have thought? But I did get to single ones. I didn't get to actually play much at Alt Control GDC, but you almost don't need to because it's a lot of them are just kind of crazy one-off conceptual installations where, like, once you see how it works, you're like, oh, okay, I get it now.
Yeah. They're kind of performance pieces almost.
Yeah.
They?
So one of them was a game that you play on an embroidery machine. And it's a, like, sort of programmable sewing machine that, so the map on which you play is a piece of cloth with a kind of hex landscape already embroidered on it. I think it's embroidered, maybe it's printed. But once it's fed into the machine, then you and another player will take it in turns to kind of competitively explore the land. And the idea is you're both part of a scouting party, but you're sort of competing to explore the best territory. And the reason that you are both part of the same party is, despite being rivals, is that with a sewing machine, all it can do is stitch things into the world. It can't take anything back out. And wherever it finishes up at the end of one person's turn, it's going to be there at the start of the other person's turn. Cool. So you can't, you can't jump around. And the idea is basically on your turn, you have a certain number of, like, I don't know, effort points. I don't remember what they're called. I guess action points or something. I think it is effort, actually, because you have to spend more effort to get through a forest and less to get through a field, but also things have different values too. So I think forest is slightly more valuable, but towns are easy to get through and have loads of value. And so you're trying to like pick your route, like which direction do you go to get the most value of your turn. And then for each square that you claim, it embroiders your logo on it. So each player has like a different emblem. And because it can't really do different colors, because it can't change thread mid-game either. Mm. But it can do incredibly fine detail. So you just have like this little stamp of your emblem on each of the tiles that you took. The tiles are like tiny, sort of less than a centimeter across. And yeah, they look really cool. I didn't get to play it because it seems to be quite a long game. And so the people playing it were like only halfway through in the time I watched. And then there's one that you control with three wooden wheels that are all hooked up to cogs. And in the first, it's three player and you all control a different like wheel. And it has a certain amount of like inbuilt resistance, sort of force feedback. And in the first level we played, they all just controlled thrusters on a spaceship and you just had to align them and you know, sort of agree on where you're going in order to play effectively. But then in the next level, one of us was, I think I was controlling the thruster with my big orange wheel, and then my friend Brendan was controlling the shield with a blue wheel, and then the person who was demoing it was controlling the torch that we had, and we had to like collect the blue things and avoid the red things. But we couldn't see any of them unless the torch was pointing at them. So she would have to like sweep the torch around to see where we're going. I would have to decide whether we're going to go that way or not. And then if there's bad things in the way, Brendan had to figure out how to defend us from it. So quite a lot like Lovers in a Dangerous Space Time, but with a big physical controller. That was kind of cool. Then there's a Hoover that challenged you to suck up color from the world, like the real world. It's a real Hoover, and its tube is illuminated gloriously with like sort of streams of LEDs, and it has a huge design flaw. And see if you can spot it in the description of the game. The Hoover is challenging you to find different colors in the world, and the way that it shows you which color you need to find next is its top lights up with that color. And then you have to put the end of the Hoover on something that is that color, and it'll suck it into the Hoover.
You Hoover the Hoover?
Yes, you can. That's no way of telling that you are Hoovering itself. And so pretty quickly, I wasn't even playing, but the guy playing it very quickly figured out, I could just point this at the example of the color, and it's a perfect match for the color you want me to find. It's exactly dead on. And then I think the creator of the game said, oh, that's cheating. And so I took a photo of the top of the Hoover and then had him scan my phone. Yeah, you probably need a different indication method for what kind of color you got to find.
Who hoovers the Hoover?
The Hoover itself, apparently.
Yeah. What have you been playing, Alex? We can return to GDC presently, but figure.
I've been playing old games.
It's old
been,
games?
I'd never got around to playing Mass Effect.
Oh, really?
Until recently. So I finished Mass Effect 2 last week. And
have you started from the start of the series?
No, I didn't do number one. I didn't have a copy, and and it's probably like not as good, probably because it's older, probably.
So, like gameplay mechanics wise, yes, but story wise,
yeah, I was kind of like slightly at sea at the start of Mass Effect 2, but it's pretty good actually. You know, it's pretty good at explaining what you don't know and not making you feel too panicky when it's talking about stuff you don't know. There are some characters that pop up and you go thinking this person has no kind of relevance to me at all. But it's been really interesting to see how, like, now I've started three, just how different it is to the two, like how uneven it is.
All three of them are very different to each other.
Yeah, like the, so two was pretty good at not being too obvious with its kind of renegade and paragon options. Like, you know, it was generally you knew which was going to be, but like usually, you know, it had a sense of kind of analogness to it to a degree, you know, and you'd be making choices that, I don't know, it felt more natural. But like three, just over and over again, there's like the top right option is paragon, and every conversation it feels like so far has had, you know, this option: top right paragon option, bottom right the renegade.
That's true in all three games.
Really?
The positioning is always right. Is
that's
always
really strange. Maybe it's writing then. It's really interesting.
It might be well yeah, writing. But that, so that is obvious. Consistent. Like, that
and, like, and it's like the option, the kind of example text is always like, it's just so obviously bad. Oh, here I am saying something bad about, you know, something about the croak and race relations and things. And that'll be the renegade option. So yeah, and it's very fighty so far as well. And it's like kind of like some of the dramatic sort of sequences are kind of slightly awkward. They don't flow as well as two. It's interesting.
I think three, my feeling about it, I actually agree with some of the criticism. I love my list of that goes 1-3-2 for me, weirdly. But I think three earns its big season. Like, three is a series of season finales.
Yeah,
like it's like the first two games are like watching the middle, like the first game is the first part of three different series of a sci-fi TV show. The second game is the middle part of three of those seasons, and then three is all three of the season finales back to back, basically. Yeah. And it earns that more the more of a run up you've had. I think weirdly, even though you don't need the narrative detail from the first one, you almost need just the time with those characters and ideas for the fact that three is just a series of climaxes to not feel weird. If you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, I do, yeah. Because I think maybe that explains why some bits felt a bit flat. But it does, you know, it sets up the peril pretty well. You know, it does feel like the clock is ticking. And I mean, I'm enjoying it. And also, like, the gunplay is so much nicer than in, or more interesting than in two.
What class are you playing?
Snipey.
Snipey class.
Yeah.
Good headshots in that game.
Good, very good headshots. And, yeah, and like I, you know, it's the ultimate kind of cliche, but like, you know, my Shepherd is definitely my Shepherd. Like, she is cool, and like she looks good as well. She looks less weird than almost every other character in the game.
I find it really weird. I guess I was kind of lucky in that I reviewed Mass Effect 1, so at the time I played it, I'd never seen a female Shepherd of any kind, I don't think.
Yeah.
And so the one I designed is just the canonical one, even more so than, you know, if I had been exposed to other people's Shepherds beforehand. So anytime I see any other Shepherd, it just freaks me the fuck out because the voice is exactly the same and the face is all wrong. What are you doing?
Well, that's, yeah, like at the start of three, you get a choice to edit your character if you've taken a save from your last game. And you can then sort of see the generic female Fem Shep. Like, who the hell would choose that? Like, what?
I don't remember what the generic one looks
as,
like.
As somebody
he's red hair and kind of, yeah.
Yeah, as somebody who played male Shepherd for Mass Effect.
Oh, he's a goof though, isn't he? He's
a goof. I actually really like, I actually think Mark Meer's voice acting job in that series is as good as Jennifer Hale's. It's just, I think male Shep has some duff lines. I think they both have some duff lines, actually. But is a bit more neutral.
How different are the lines between? Do they say the same line? Like, they do not say the same lines?
Sometimes they say the same lines. Sometimes they say different lines.
Interesting, yeah.
Sometimes simply putting the emphasis in a different place in a sentence.
Yeah.
Changes the way the sentence feels quite substantially. Male Shepherd is more explicitly Canadian in several places. Like, there's a line in Mass Effect 2 where you can run into a character from Mass Effect 1 who is like a criminal, and maybe you let them go, and they show up in Mass Effect 2, and you can ask them, like, have you gone back to your life of crime, kind of thing. And I think the line should be just like, so what are you doing then, eh? And he Canada's that one up, like, give me mommy who's Canadian. And most of the time it doesn't really creep out, but there's that kind of like, what have you been doing then, eh? And it's like, what the, like, there's a genuine like double take moment. But actually also I think I think Jennifer Hale is an amazing like best of the best in voice acting.
Given
the
sheer amount of dialogue and how kind of sort of splintered it all is, she's amazingly consistent.
So this is more of a, yeah, I think she's amazingly consistent. I think she's more of a defense of Mark Meer, who gets, I think, an unfair rap for not being probably as good across the course of the series, but I think he really has his moments. He's very funny. Like, I think the funnier, the series gets funnier as it goes on. Mass Effect 3 being the funniest, and the DLC for Mass Effect 3 being the best comedy they've done in that series. He's got really good comic delivery as well. So I would defend the male Shep version of that game, because I think it has its own highlights. And I think some of his delivery, particularly, epilogue to Lair of the Shadowbroker, which is DLC for the second game.
Okay.
Is very good. But I've got opinions about this shit. But like, yeah, I would totally say it's not totally invalid to play that game as Mail Shep, but for the sake of probably having a more interesting protagonist in a game than you would otherwise have, not to do that.
I've been playing another game that's full of talking, so I've just been basically just spending a lot of time listening to people talking in games, which is Danganronpa. Do you know?
Is this the one about a robot bear that's murdering people in a school?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's surprisingly so. Like,
obviously, so a talkie.
It's all talking. It's a Japanese kind of visual novel thing with a fairly awkward kind of game on top of it. But I just found it super fun. Like the set. Do you know the setup? Like the setup is.
No,
I vaguely do, but I wouldn't be able to quote it.
So, like, 15 school students have been invited to continue their studies at called Hope's Peak Academy, which is like which selects only the very finest student from kind of, you know, from various fields. They've all found themselves there, but they've all woken up. Kind of, you know, they kind of collapse before entering and find themselves waking up in the sort of entrance kind of room, and this bear appears talking to them. He's kind of black and white, one side black, one side white, and with a red evil looking eye on the black side, and kind of like a teddy bear eye on the other side. So, like, hey, he doesn't look like a good guy, and the setup is that this school, they've been barricaded into the school. They can't get out. Like, every door and window has been kind of sort of sealed shut with steel plates. They can't get out. And the bear tells them that gives one of those social experiment style kind of setups, so that these kids, one of them can get out if they can kill one of the other students and not be found out. On the death of a student, they're all taken into a trial. And at the end of this trial, all of the students have to vote on who they think did it. Now, if they vote wrong, all of the students will die. And if they vote right, all of the students will die except for the culprit. And if they vote correctly, then the culprit will be killed in a very kind of colourful manner.
And do the rest get to go free, or do they do it again?
And they all get to go free. Yeah. Oh, no, they don't get free. No, sorry. And they all remain there, and they continue.
Right.
So basically, your only way out only is to murder someone. And like, it's manages to get away with it for the fact that the characters are just so colourful and interesting, and it's frequently very funny and profane and sort of knowing, and like, it's just really entertaining. It's like 20, I think my playtime was like 25 hours or something.
Holy shit.
It's insanely long. Like, and like, each of the, basically what it devolves down to is a series of maybe 10 murder mysteries, and they are insanely complex. Insanely. So basically, you know, the murder happens. You get a period where you get directed around the school looking for clues and things. It's all totally linear. Then you go into the trial, and then all of these little clues combine together into ways that sometimes you can feel your way. Like, you can think, I think it's going to be that, but often it's totally, you know.
Do you not fire them out of a gun as truth bullets?
You do. Okay. Yeah. So this is the side of the game that I kind of didn't get on with so well. It's as if they sort of thought, well, you've got to put some game in here. And so each of the parts of the trial, kind of, there are these little sort of weird little mini games. So sometimes you are forced to find the inconsistency in what somebody says. So you have a truth bullet, which is a piece of evidence, and you have several of these truth bullets. You have to choose the right one. And this guy, person is making statements, and then you have to fire the bullet into the correct statement, and it's kind of an irritating. There's another one where you have to sort of, there's a hangman sort of word, and you've got to sort of select the letters that fill the word, and it's kind of crap up stuff, but like, the story itself, and you can actually turn down the difficulty and really kind of just get rid of that stuff. Like, the story itself, super fun.
I've heard that was a recent arrival on PC, isn't it? Because it was originally a Vita game, is that true?
I think it was
true?
A PSP game years ago, and then it went to Vita, but yeah, it came out on PC like maybe a month ago or something.
Yeah. people raving about it in that sort of Persona-ish kind of cult way that people rave about games like that.
Yeah, I mean, I must admit, I played it on Vita, and like, it's a, I don't know what it'd be like to sit at your desk reading small, like, sort of,
is it voice acted or is it?
Yeah, it is, but well, no, actually, maybe about just the major parts are voice acted. So most of it's just reading text.
What have you been playing, Chris?
So I've mostly been, well, I'm playing XCOM, but no one wants to hear me talk about XCOM. I'm almost at the end of XCOM. I'm actually now so far ahead in XCOM that I'm just sort of like doing victory laps of the planet before, like, you know, I've now gotten every single continental bonus. I've got, I'm trying to see how successfully we can do missions now with my kind of like A team, with who are all colonels. Everyone's a colonel. Managed to do just a regular mission, like capture the device sort of style thing in 3 turns, flawless with no one getting hurt, which was kind of only possible because of the mechanic where you can hack sort of advent installations out in the wild and you have like a random bonus, and sometimes it'll be some intel or something like that. In this case, it was the last action and the soldier had nothing else to do, so I was like, hack it. And the bonus was refund all action points spent this time for everybody. And so the entire squad could just move over and it was like, oh, I've finished this entire mission now. So for some reason, I don't want it to end yet because I'm really enjoying it, but it's sort of completely undermined the setting now that XCOM is just doing victory laps in the Avenger. Nothing can stop them. There are no new enemies to encounter. It's kind of gotten trivial, which is, I guess, maybe a disappointment because I was hoping that new XCOM wouldn't reach that point. But I think it's only happened as well because I sort of didn't really game it, but I got to the point where I was powerful enough to end the game and I just kept going. Which
did you find this, you found the same thing as Tom where you got to a stage where like your A team was just so good?
It's like A team and now the B team as well. Yeah. Like I can sort of rotate people in and out, and while people were getting hurt, that was a thing, bringing other people in, bringing in psychic soldiers and stuff like that. Now it's just so I did a thing where I made like loads of my, you know, friends, all the Crate and Crowbar people, PC gamer people, people I play online games with, and, you know, family members and stuff, and used its system where you can kind of just seed, but rather than like force it to use people I knew, I just let it seed the world with them. So random people would show up in different parts of the world. So, you know, Andy Kelly, who I work with on PC Gamer, showed up as a scientist on one mission that I was rescuing from a building. Whereas like a bunch of my friends have shown up as soldiers. So the A team is like entirely people I know, but like, and over the course of when it was hard, I didn't really like, there's lots of people who just showed up as recruits that I didn't hire. But now that I have the continent bonus, that means the recruits are only 10 supply. I've just went through and like hired all of them. So everyone I know who's on the recruits menu has been hired. Everyone I know who was in the resistance headquarters waiting to be hired has been hired. So people just, then it's like, I should probably train Tom Senior as a psychic. So I'll do that for 5 days while I'm doing other things.
How does the avatar thing work at that point? Is there still, do you keep discovering sites?
They will still construct sites, but because I have access to every region, I can immediately destroy them, which must be incredibly frustrating. Because like sometimes I'll just leave them there for a while to let them cook a bit so that I get more satisfying pips off the counter when I destroy them. Lee is just toying with them at this point. Like, there's a lot of things I really like about that game. Sorry, I've said no one wants to hear me talk about XCOM, but I really like how the Proving Ground, which is like where you get the experimental weapons, it's randomized what you get. Like, I didn't actually realize that at first when it said, like, you know, experimental powered weapon, which is like weapon you can use on the wrist mounted launcher on the special massive exoskeleton, the highest tier of armor you can get. Some, like, I've got 2 of them now, and the first one was like a kind of rocket that like fires through walls, and the other one's like the world's longest shotgun, like the infinite shotgun that will destroy everything in a cone forever on the entire map. So I have that on Sam Roberts, editor of PC Gamer. And so Sam Roberts' job is just to run ahead of everybody and just like figure out where the objective is, hopefully position himself so there's maximum number of enemies possible between him and the objective, and then just open the infinite corridor towards wherever it is we're going with the mega gun. There's a few nice AI things I discovered. So on the retaliation missions where you rescue civilians, what I found is you can mind control an advent soldier and get them to rescue the civilians for you. Nice. By running them around ahead of you, because then there's no danger. And if something turns out to be a trap, for example, doesn't matter because it's just some random advent shield bearer that I mind controlled. I tried that with a chrysalid, with a mind controlled chrysalid, and the civilians will not accept evacuation advice from a terrifying insect monster. The civilians will run away from the chrysalid, sometimes in the opposite direction you want them to be running in. So the pet chrysalid strategy is,
you're
not
safe now. You may run away. Ignore anyone else who looks like me.
I don't know why they sound like Daleks, but so that strategy doesn't work, but the distraction chrysalid totally does. Just run them into whatever.
I was disappointed when I mind control an enemy who is mind controlling one of my people, and I wanted to get my person back, but it didn't work.
Weird, yeah. I've tried to mind control a different thing in every mission, just to kind of, you know,
for variety's sake.
Yeah, variety's sake. Like some things I learned, like if you mind control an Andromedon, which is the enemy that it's like you kill it, and then that means the alien inside the suit is dead, but the suit still has its own AI, yeah, and the suit keeps fighting. You're only mind controlling the alien, yeah, you're not mind controlling the suit. So if the alien dies, the suit goes back to being evil, which is a thing.
You can mind control the alien, and then when the alien dies, you can hack the suit because it's a robot.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. But yeah, so it's great. It unfortunately has that XCOM power spike thing where it's like, I'm now powerful enough that nothing can seriously go wrong. But I was playing that partly because it now runs really well, because my thing recently, I bought myself a new PC. So having had a 5-year-old PC that wasn't running things particularly well anymore, most of my game time recently has just been spent going back to things that I now want to look at. So I reinstalled GTA 5 to go, oh, look, and that was fine. I reinstalled Fallout 4 because I had to stop playing that, because as soon as that game sent me to Central Boston, my old PC could no longer handle it. So I might get back into that. But the thing that sort of ended up creeping out of it, and that I've been playing more than I really should because it's not good, is Star Wars Battlefront, which I don't like. It's not good. But, you know, I previously hadn't played it at home because it just didn't run on my old PC. And now it obviously runs perfectly with everything turned up. And the one thing you can say for that game is it is beautiful. Like, they did a spectacular job on the special effects and the models and stuff. And so it's kind of nice to run around and sort of see it. The thing about it is I can play it for 15 minutes and it's a fine experience of shooting spectacular things in a totally meaningless, empty way. And because it's completely devoid of any competitive merit, I don't really feel the need to get better at it. And I don't feel bad if I'm bad at it, which is kind of rare for me because I'm someone who's very competitive. and because it's sort of like, and yeah, for the same reason, I don't really feel bad about quitting it. So like before you guys came around to do this podcast, I was just playing a round of it. And then I heard the doorbell, instantly quit. And so I didn't really have a game like that that I could just dip into for 5-10 minutes and not really think twice about, because everything else I either take too seriously or it's Dota and you have to play for an hour and that's that.
So what's drawing you back then? Because like,
I do like Star Wars a lot, so there's that. Yeah. But I mean, and there are other better games that could fill this. And the reason that I can't use that as a basis for a serious recommendation is that it's like a £50 game. And I don't think I would recommend someone pay £50 for a game that, like, its purpose is to be the thing you boot up for 5 minutes and go, this is crap, but, you know. Like, I'm playing it because I like Star Wars lights and sounds. They make my brain happy because I'm fundamentally 7. And, like,
it's pretty good at kind of explosive moments as well. Like,
it is, just, yeah.
I mean, it feels just smooth.
It does feel smooth. It is bum.
Yeah.
But it's a smooth bum. and so I feel like I could sort of dip into it. And, you know, I should probably say, like, this was because when it came out, you know, EA sent an email with a whole bunch of codes for it. So I've never had to spend any money on it. I think if I'd put money down, it's like, this was my Christmas game for last year, and this was the thing I was going to invest 50 quid in, plus another 40 quid for a season pass kind of thing, because it just had its new DLC this week, actually, I think. So it is vaguely topical. I would be very disappointed, I think, and would continue to be as disappointed in it being duff as I am, really. But it sort of regained a place in my life because it's just like the spectacular Star Wars show. On the new DLC, actually, speaking of disappointment, they've done the strangest thing I can think. I mean, I already spoke about on the podcast making fun of its hero mode, right, where you might be hunting Emperor Palpatine who's hiding in a tree and so on. Shouting lines from the movie as he goes. That still strikes me, actually, playing it, and you just hear Darth Vader in the distance bellowing. Like, he's not a bellower, right? Like, he's an imposing dark presence in the film. He's not just a shouty man gliding around in the distance. So the new expansion is sort of called Outer Rim, and it's like the the criminal element. You know, it's got Jabba's bounties now because it needed to be more of a theme park. So Jabba's apparently paying members of both sides of the Galactic Civil War to get 3 blaster rifle kills.
It's crazy. Why would they? They're just trying to put a story in.
I don't know
got
what
to justify it.
Don't know what the fuck they're doing. But okay, so they got. So they want to add a new hero to each faction, right? A criminal themed hero to each faction. So to clarify, the Rebellion already has Leia, Luke, and Han, and the Empire has the Emperor, Darth Vader, and Boba Fett. Admittedly, the Empire is in slightly trickier situation because beyond those three, there aren't that many named Imperial baddies. There's like, you know, Commander Chokey and, like, you know, some stormtroopers.
Chatty stormtrooper number 5.
Yeah, exactly. And
what about those red dudes who are like,
oh, yeah,
kind of the Imperial Guard? Well, actually, I think they might be adding them.
I don't think they've ever said anything.
Red man.
Yeah, red.
See, if they were, the moment they would be willing to dip into the old expanded universe that they've since gotten rid of, they would be absolutely awashing characters they could use because those guys have names. But because they're not, they can't. But given that it's sort of underworld themed, they could go for any of the other bounty hunters who are in Empire Strikes Back that you see in the distance, like IG-88, who's a cool droid with like.
Is he the one with the tall droidy head?
Yeah, covered in guns. Like, those are characters like that. And there's two obvious candidates for the Rebellion, and they're really, really fucking obvious. One of them is Chewbacca, right? Like, that's a popular character. The other is Lando.
Well, I was thinking,
yeah, you know what I mean? Like, Lando. Surely, it's obviously Lando.
If it's got to be Lando.
If you're going for the criminal one, it's pretty fucking obvious.
But Lando doesn't do, like, what does Lando do? Lando has a cheeky smile. Like,
what does Leia do? They gave Leia abilities, like, to, like, put down shields and summon people and stuff like that. Mm. You know, it's more about the character, right? And, like, you know, Lando's a Rebellion general, whatever. I mean, I'm a bit of a Lando fan, so bear with me. But, right... So, do you know who they added for the Rebels?
Go for it.
Nian Numb.
So, is he the co-pilot in the
He's the co-pilot in the Millennium Falcon in the third film.
The one with the funny... Yeah,
the one with the sort of squashy face. He's in The Force Awakens as well as the Millennium pilot in the background. And it's not that's not, like, racist or anything. He's an alien, so it's fine. he's the one with the squashy face who laughs.
Yeah, he sits pretty in the much co-pilot
and there's the Death Star, he goes, and that's it.
And he's the co-pilot as well. Like, he's not even.
He doesn't really fucking do anything.
Doesn't do anything.
No. No, exactly. Nian Numb is in there.
That's a great choice.
What an iconic character. So, the next expansion is called Cloud City. So maybe they're saving Lando for that. But in which case, add Chewbacca.
Yeah.
Why not Chewbacca? The obvious. So anyway, so that's dumb choice one, right? Like, why would you fucking, do you go for that character? Like, guess who they picked for the Empire? Greedo.
Because he's obviously like an Empire guy.
Yeah, because he's a bounty hunter who is working on behalf of Jabba the Hutt, who's shot under a table, either first or second.
So this explains why I saw a headline saying, finally, Battlefront answers the age-old conundrum of who shot first.
It's not really a conundrum, is it?
Yeah,
it's just
no,
in
it's
one
not.
Film this happened and
and also the game probably doesn't even...
Well, no, because Greedo's special ability is some kind of bullet time thing where he shoots lots of different people at once. Because obviously, if he'd had that, maybe he wouldn't have been shot under a table.
Oh, the only thing he's known for is getting shot.
It's like, this is... I don't understand how you can orbital fuck it like that. Like,
it sounds like DLC's schedule is the orbital fuck up here. Like, oh, we've got to hold Lando
surely, like, I mean, you can say a lot of things about licensed games and Star Wars games. Star Wars is pretty rich in stuff you can put in things, right? Like, it's got characters people like in it. You can mix things up, you can change things around, but that's fine. And it's not about getting snippy about canon. It's like, why would you choose... Like, why you maybe you've done A list, but why would then you skip to G list past all of the other characters to go like, oh, Greedo, who's waiting to run around the multiplayer map as as man in a waistcoat who dies within 20 seconds of you meeting him in order to set up a different character, Greedo.
They should put the Sarlacc pit in.
They should,
play as a playable Sarlacc.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God, it's just. It's so weird. I don't know why it's so bad. I don't know why I still play it. I mean, I think more than anything, I desperately want someone to make a good Star Wars game again. It feels like it's been a long time. Like, given that it's been you know, we, on the last episode of the podcast, we ended up having a series of revelations of how long it's been since various things. Like, you know, 18 years since Half-Life, 10 years since Oblivion, 5 years since Skyrim this year, which is all these things are kind of crazy. Coming up on 5 years since Mass Effect 3.
So it's been as long since Skyrim as Skyrim was since Oblivion.
Yeah, like Mass Effect 1 is 10 years old next year. Like, all of these things should make you fear for death. but the one that gets me is, like, Knights of the Old Republic is now 15 years old.
Mm.
And that's kind of nuts. Like, I want someone to make, you know, Frostbite Engine X-Wing Alliance, or even Frostbite Engine Jedi Knight 2, you know? Like, one of these games has actual merit.
I just continually wonder what holds it back.
What's the thing?
Because they just, like, is it a matter of, like, red tape, bureaucracy? Is it a matter of gatekeepers to it, just sort of not letting the skillful teams work on it?
I don't know, because Disney...
politics?
Disney said that they were going to only do mobile games. And that's what reportedly killed Star Wars 1313, which is...
Although, I mean, that's not... you know, that was clearly, like, them...
wanting Uncharted.
Yeah.
But it was also going to be a Boba Fett game, so... And it was reportedly linked to the defunct attempt to do a sort of Star Wars Underworld live-action TV series before the new movies became a thing, back when Lucas was still involved. So, obviously, there's been a lot of kind of... I wonder if partly, like... It was all a giant fucking crazy mess until the new movie came along, and it was an enormous success, and it was probably going to be an enormous success, and things sort of, and Disney's resources and interest in Star Wars kind of got revamped.
And the success of Battlefront as well, like, it's been a successful game, right?
I guess so. But how would you not release a successful first-person shooter at Christmas the same year as a new Star Wars movie? Like,
yeah, but we're not talking about people with grand imaginations, you know, like, being in charge of the purse strings.
No, for sure. But, like, Battlefront feels like the most impressive, like, visually, technologically game you can make quickly. Because there's not a lot to it.
Yeah, it definitely looks like that.
And, you know, whereas something more substantial, something with a narrative, like, you know, I mean, there's problems with it, but something like Force Unleashed was sort of the last attempt by the previous generation of Star Wars games to do a big Star Wars. And it was this sort of, you know, we're doing it. It was Shadows of the Empire 2. It's, we're doing another canon thing. It's all going to be, it's all real. This really happened. This man really did fight a robot that was pretending to be Darth Maul. And so on. And Battlefront, the new stuff has none of that ambition. It's probably the thing is sort of, it is just completely content to be a sort of little Star Wars roadshow that you dip in and out of that's incredibly expensive. Whereas, like, and what I'm kind of waiting for them to do is to sort of sit up and say, okay, here is a meaningful Star Wars game. Like, here is a new story being told in this license, or here's a new experience or something.
Yeah. Or, like, somewhat player-directed or something as well. Yeah. You know? Like
here's a character public. You wouldn't have otherwise met.
Yeah.
Any more GDC stories? Did you play... No, you didn't play any VR stuff, so you wouldn't have played VR Star Wars, which is the only thing I want to do.
No. There was... I sort of didn't... I could have gone to the Vive thing, but I've ordered one, and it's going to come quite soon, so I figured that was a silly thing to do, really. Because there's a bunch of stuff that you kind of can't do elsewhere. I did see the Game Design Challenge, which is the thing they used to do every year at GDC, where they sort of take... four game designers and give them one theme, and they have to sort of come up with something to, and then make a presentation about it. They don't have to make the game, they just have to say what they would make. And the theme this year is a game you can play for 30 years, or a game that where playing it takes 30 years, or some variation on that. And there were various good ideas. My favorite is the one that won, which was by Anna Kipnis of Double Fine. I just like it as a game. It's the 30-year part doesn't sort of feel like it's a core part of it, but the idea is she was inspired by an app where you take a second of video every day and then you compile it into like 365 seconds at the end of the year, and it's weirdly affecting to kind of watch just a tiny glimpse, even if it's just mundane things every day. Sort of like gives you that passage of time, and she wanted to make a game that was kind of about reflecting on the last 30 years of your life. And so the game itself is something you play with another person, and you draw a picture. It's not actually a computer game, it's just something you do on paper. Or you could do it on like an iPad or something. You draw a picture and you leave something missing out of it, and you put a question mark there, and then you pass it to the other person, they fill it in with whatever they think should go there. And then when they give it back to you, you kind of analyze their mental state based on what they drew. So I played it with a friend, and he drew like what looked to me like it was just an arrow pointing into nothing. And so I drew it, I filled in the rest of the picture as like a deep pit with a corpse at the bottom. So the arrow is pointing to the corpse. A pointing hand is pointing to the corpse. And he interpreted this as like, I think he misread my drawing as like a man sort of throwing himself into a pit. And so his conclusion was that I, for some reason, really like people throwing themselves into pits. I drew him like a map of the world and a plane and that question mark next to it, sort of like asking like where he'd like to go in the world. And he drew a trajectory for it that would loop around the world infinitely. So I concluded that he's scared of commitment. So it's a really fun game to play, but it's I don't know that you would ever compile all of your drawings over 30 years. And if you did, it doesn't sort of offer a particular way to get an overview of them, right? You'd have to just look through them all, which might be interesting. But
it's weird, like those sort of things also depend on you not having to put anything creative into each of those individual things. Like having to think of a picture every day.
I think that is probably the way to go. Like, if you want to leverage the 30-year thing, is to kind of leverage human or user input to get them to make something or do something or have the effect of your total playtime be something that is kind of compiled that you look back on and is the sum total of, you know, because over 30 years you can put in an extraordinarily low amount of effort and still have something quite substantial at the end. Even if it was like just one drawing where you just modify it again and again and again, then maybe it animates at the end or something. But the best use of the 30 years was from an idea by Zach Gage, which was not actually his submission. His final submission was a lamp that changes color over time, which is cool for a lamp, but I mean, like, not to get game policey on it, but I struggle to say that's a lamp. Yeah, it's so the idea is it goes through all of the 16.8 million colors possible over a course of 30 years, so it takes that long to do it. But it's like a web URL, so you point any device to it, so when your device dies you get a new one plug in. The idea is like when you get a new phone, use your old phone to just display this URL constantly, and it's just a color, which is kind of a nice thing as lamps go. But his best idea was one he abandoned. Well, he didn't abandon it. He actually made it, but it wasn't his submission, where I think it's just called like Duel or something, and you challenge someone to it, and you both go to this website, and it gives you, you can select the 15-year version or the full 30-year version, and then it gives you both a URL, one for you and one for your partner or opponent. And you've got to remember that URL or note it down, because the person who wins is the first person to visit that URL after 30 years. So it's like a quick draw duel, but with a 30-year delay.
There was that Michael, is it Brog? Brog?
Bro.
Bro game. And I can't remember what it's called. It began with S. Mm. And you played like...
It was one move every day.
One move every day. And I found it like surprisingly...
Affecting,
yeah. Like, really small things would happen, like certain squares you could move into, and like, because you were investing a shitload of time into moving like to the square over there, you know, in order to get this thing, when you saw this little pixelated picture pop up, you know, that did nothing, you know, just it worked really well.
I really like the idea of those like reconnecting after a substantial amount of time games. Not sure if the competitive context necessarily is going to lend it favors, because if your friend or partner or your dual partner like passes away in that time, then your victory in 30 years is going to be really fancy. I win.
Got you, you fucker.
Like, yeah. I mean, having that kind of like, this is who you were then, this is who you are now kind of thing. Apparently that's just like an asshole and an asshole.
I like the idea of just being like 65 or something and going around your 68-year-old friend's house and on like the eve of the timer expiring and restraining him or something. Yeah, exactly. He can't get there first.
Oh, good Lord, you just remind me, like, in 30 years' time, I'm going to be 70.
Yep. We're all going to be pretty old.
Oh.
What game will you wish you'd played for 30 years when you're 70?
Star Wars Battlefront. I hope he's still going.
Really?
Well, with the DLC plan they've got, so you'll be playing until the day you die.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be 58. That's right.
Yeah, you've still got life in you.
Yeah.
still another 10 years before you can retire.
No, by that point, 40, surely.
There'll be no retiring.
It'll either be 40 years till I can retire, or 28 years since I was euthanized. In the manner of Logan's Run.
Our retirement's going to be weird because the thing we do is already something we can do in our retirement.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of our social connections don't depend
no
on
the game. No game journalist has ever had to retire, so it's unprecedented territory.
Or been able to.
Yeah, exactly.
Maybe we will be so put off by all these modern games by then that not understanding what any of the kids are playing at that point.
To some extent, it's already happened.
Like, I was going to say.
I don't think I like Candy Crush. It's not really played by kids predominantly, but whatever kids do play, I probably don't like it very much. I mean, kids play Minecraft. I quite like Minecraft.
Imagine what the thing is going to be that makes the Clash of Clans community angry at its existence.
Those fucking kids.
Yeah. Imagine.
I mean, maybe it'll be VR stuff. Maybe this new frontier of VR, like, oh, it's also different and exciting and new. The result of that will be just like, we don't like it, but the kids do.
It's just going to be people just motionless for days on end, kind of with nutrition kind of tubes going into their bodies. And that's what we're going to be appalled by. I'm setting myself up pretty much to be enjoying being appalled by this new generation of made up people.
Got to get pre-appalled.
Although I've kind of been fed that fantasy already.
I sort of hope that we're not appalled. Like, I hope that maybe this is the generation that is the last to be totally disgusted by what their kids are doing.
Yeah.
You know, we'll grow up.
Of our age, I think there are people who are appalled by kind of the whole concept of esports, the concept of people playing all day, every day, and burning out at whatever.
Yeah, no, that's true. Maybe there'll be new ways of playing it people find objectionable, but I don't know. It feels like, there's going to be a generation of adults who are more accepting of play as something that you continue to do into adulthood. You know, we're not necessarily had, most of us have been lucky to live in a time where we haven't necessarily had to, fight a war or die of plague.
Or grow up.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? We haven't really had to, farm our own crops or kill our own cattle.
Except in Stardew Valley.
Except in Stardew Valley, right. So, yeah, I want the future of mankind to be as a big generation of happy pudding people that have no real problems, so that we can all live in one giant puddingy brotherhood of man.
I guess maybe because cross
at each other's
getting angry on the internet. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe because all my friends are games journalists, but the big generational gap taste wise seems to be YouTubers. Most of my friends' kids have their kids watch YouTubers who they think are fucking garbage. And, they don't hate YouTubers as a concept. They're just the particular ones that kids really, really like are often the most grating to adults, I think.
That must have been true. That must be historically true, though, right? That, I don't know. Alex, you've got kids. You're in a better position to have hot takes about this than I am.
They just watch Dan TDM all day. And I have gone. And
I don't even know who that is.
I'm so old. He's got a really kind of dull voice when it's always in the background, like this sort of droning thing. But he's actually pretty good.
Was it Dan TDM?
Yeah, the Diamond Minecart. So it's Dan TDM. But he and I have gone in and said to them, why don't you play the game rather than just watch videos about it? And I just sort of held my, what am I saying? but this stuff, I had this really interesting conversation with someone, he's in his 50s and he doesn't play games, hasn't done, but he did a bit when he was a kid, when he was younger. And, but he he said, I don't understand all this YouTube stuff. But then I suppose it is a bit when I was a kid and we would just, take turns we'd spend most of the time around your friends watching them play and then you'd have your go.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. And it's the same thing as when
you have your go
in the local shop and you just watch somebody playing in the shop. It's exactly the same impulse, So actually, it feels kind of alien, but it's not. It's super innate.
I think it's the distressing thing is just seeing the shape of the things you're going to be old about one day.
Yeah.
I spent £1 to play GoldenEye 15 minutes in my local independent game shop. Couldn't just watch a wanker play it on the internet.
That cartridge cost for £70, though, so, that's a good deal.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
I mean, one of the things they'll their generation will miss out on game-wise is they'll never have a game where they can't find out what happens next. There'll never be that sense of mystery of like, you know, I never got past level 6 and I never found out what's on level 7. Or
But the game, the form of games is changing to respond to that. Like, so, because games now are full of immersion discovery where, like, your experience of it is going to be different to the person who you've been watching.
Or, yeah, I suppose there's...
Or so full of discoveries that in order to know what the game is... like you kind of have to watch.
Yeah, I don't think children's imaginations have changed. Like, so it struck this, you know, proofing and working on Minecraft stuff is that, like, Herobrine, which is the evil version of the main Minecraft character that a lot of children believe haunts actual Minecraft and can invade your servers and delete your stuff, is just the new version of the story, you know, the My Uncle Works at Nintendo and He Said story that people would share about Mega Man or something
like that. Like, but it's amazing how prevalent, like, the Herobrine thing is fascinating. So I wrote a book about Minecraft called the Minecraft Logopedia, and it means that now and then I do talks for kids about the book and about blocks in the game, and they are usually between the ages of 5 and 10, like, or 10 or 11, and they are mad about Minecraft, and they come up to me and they say, you know, what's it like working with Notch? Like, so for them, despite a lot of them, Notch probably left, like, stopped developing the game way before they could even talk, you know, but he's so totally.
God, that's
and then the second question is, like, you know, sort of, so, is Herobrine real? Or more, actually more frequently, sort of like, how do you see Herobrine? Because he's definitely part of the game. You know, it's fascinating. Like, this is just folk stuff. You know, these kids don't read about the game that much, you know. It's just like
yeah, improved access to information has no effect on that.
Yeah,
like the fact that there's a guide available around every corner and the client can be data mined to prove without reasonable doubt that there's nothing like that in it, it doesn't matter.
It totally doesn't matter, because you want it to exist as well. You want this to be a secret that you haven't seen.
Yeah,
I remember I thought there was someone following me in Morrowind for years. Because I think it's just like a sound effect. It's meant to be ambient, kind of rocks, I don't know, falling down a cliff for some reason. But it just sounds like someone walking behind you. Like someone's just kind of disturbed something slightly.
And then
behind
when you turned around, there's only one set of footsteps. That's
there were no sets of footsteps because there were no decals in that
game. Carried you. But like Creepypasta is an example of like the exact same thing as well. Like the idea that there's... games can be haunted or, you know, like, I don't know, like, it feels to me that, like, the generation, I don't know what the generation below mine is called necessarily, if people aren't as angry at it. But, you know, the appetite for horror and Slenderman and Five Nights at Freddy's and stuff seems to stem from, again, that desire for there to be kind of, like, hidden extremes to games that the internet can't tell you about necessarily. Like, they've regained that sort of, like, oh, you should have seen this secret thing in this game, it's terrifying, that games used to have and is now basically just, you know, disseminated through YouTubers. Like, that's one of the most striking thing about me for YouTubers I initially found really objectionable, which is like YouTubers for kids are one of the most prolific vectors for horror.
Yeah,
like for sharing horror games. Yeah, there is, right? And that's, you know, that's partly part of the loophole is I can't play this game because it's a 15 or an 18.
Yeah,
but I can, my parents aren't going to notice if I jump on a YouTube channel to watch it. But, you know, it is definitely filling that gap of, like, you know, I used to go around my mate's house and we'd play games on his big brother's PlayStation that were way too old for us. And that is clearly the gap being filled, but on, like, a kind of industrial scale by YouTubers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Activision started blocking my Let's Plays of Modern Warfare 3. Is that the one with the augmented arms and stuff?
What? I guess.
I did a Let's Play series of it, like 20 videos, and they just yesterday they blocked one on YouTube on a copyright claim, and it tells you what specific part of the video it is, and I watched it, and it's a cutscene. Well, not even really a cutscene, just an in-game scripted sequence where you have no control, like the Golden Gate Bridge is collapsing, and you know, it's sure, it's their game, they do own the copyright to it, but I don't know why that particular part was objectionable to them, and so far none of the rest has been.
But are there rules about people's sort of story sequences?
No, surely not. Not on Modern Warfare 3, like, now. It's a bit late, isn't it?
So much of YouTube must be taken up with videos of Modern Warfare.
Because it's like, for this to happen, I don't think it's a person has watched my video and decided to block it. It's like an algorithm. Yeah. And so that means they've uploaded that bit of the game as to the content matcher to say, if you see any of this, then block it. So can't imagine why. But it does, you know, specifically say Activision.
Weird. Nothing makes any sense anymore.
Nope.
Any further GDC stories, Tom?
There was a talk about the Indiepocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
Which was quite interesting.
Is that the end of the indie revolution?
It's kind of like... they all agree that Indiepocalypse is a terrible name for it.
That's what people have decided is true.
Yeah. But it's really like the indie glut, right? There's just a lot of indie games. And the demand for it has not gone down. It's gone up, but it hasn't gone up quite as fast as the glut of indie games. So it's harder for individual ones to get attention. And it was a kind of series of talks by Jeff Vogel of Spiderweb Software, who does Avernum, and a very similarly named game.
Avadon?
Avadon, yeah, I think you're right. Avernum and Avadon, which are two different series, and he's done like seven games in each of those series. And his was the most interesting data, I think, because he's one of the only people who can actually draw meaningful comparisons between the sales of his games. You know, everyone else, even if you do a sequel, you've done like two games, right? And even if they're quite similar, maybe the sequel didn't add enough new stuff or whatever. Whereas his series have been going so long and sold so steadily that, you know, when his sales drop in half, he can meaningfully say something's happening. Like it's, you know, it's not because this game was too radical for them or because it deviated from the formula. He's doing the same thing he's always done. He's got the same community he always has, but suddenly it's a lot harder to get sales. The other ones were Spider 2. What's it called? As a subtitle.
The Rite of the Shroud of the Rite of the Moon.
Rite of the Shrouded Moon, maybe?
Shrouded, yeah.
that was... that's probably the most dramatic one in that the first one was a massive mega hit on mobile. And then the second one, they... Like, the first one was something like 5 man-years or something. And the second one was... Oh, no. I can't remember. Like, 2 years of development. And the next one was like 7 years of development. And... it has something like 5 times the content, and it's just sort of the reason that they sort of see it as a good example is that it's sort of by all accounts better. Like the critics agree it's better. It's definitely is bigger in every way. It sort of doesn't have introduce any new flaws or anything, and it just seems like a bigger, better version of that thing. That thing was massively successful, and this has bombed on both mobile and PC. But I didn't take that as sort of particularly scary evidence for Steam, because the first one wasn't on Steam. So we don't know that the first one would have been successful on Steam. And it was successful in the App Store, but it is... I like it, but it does feel like a mobile game. I'm not at all surprised that the Steam audience rejected it, because they hate anything that looks a little bit like mobile. They'll just run from it. And so its failure to do well on Steam doesn't super surprise me. Its failure to do well on mobile, I don't understand, but I don't have any... I would never assume the mobile market is anything other than a crapshoot. It's never seemed like anything other than that. Particularly when it's, you know, I think that market has been, everyone's been muscled out of it by people who can afford to buy users, and who buy users get in the charts, and then you dominate the charts. Yeah. Everything in the charts is from companies who buy users. So it's not surprising that that's just luck, whether you manage to get past that or not. Steam, you know, I hope is a fairer market, and obviously it's not completely fair. And so it's the nature of that difficulty that's more interesting. Magic Circle guys said that they sold 14,000 units and so far, and they're on 44,000 wish lists. So they have dramatically failed to sell to the people who want it or who are interested in it. And that one, with any game, really, you can point to like, you can pick 10 things and say, these are the reasons it didn't sell. And if it didn't sell, then you can do that. And if it did sell, don't do that. Like, I could probably pick a bunch of reasons why Firewatch wouldn't sell, but it did sell massively. And I thought it would, but I also thought the Magic Circle would. Maybe not quite as much, but, I would have said that it does have some challenging things. It does have some things about it that is conceptually complicated, but you don't really know about those till you play. And before you play, it's the game that's about vaporware games, and that's a really easy subject to grasp. I thought it had a really strong hook, you know.
It's interesting, like, because I'm just thinking about it. I think I have Magic Circle on my wish list, and I think I didn't buy it.
Damn you, part of the problem.
But, well,
one of the 40K.
But equally, I have Firewatch on my wish list. I haven't bought that either. But I would, So, I mean, I really liked, I felt like I was one of those people who's primed to buy Magic Circle because I get it. I like the creative team. Mm. I've had my friends, you know, tell me about it positively and negatively and so on. But it's really ugly.
Yeah, that, I think that's the, like, that's the thing.
And mm. I, you know, like, and I would say, like, even as someone who thinks about this stuff and, like, isn't just making a flash decision based on that, there is something about how ugly it looks on the Steam store page.
Yeah.
And that it doesn't screenshot well. That right. Some sort of dumb part of my brain goes, this is not a value thing. Whereas Firewatch is beautiful and really clear and crisp and attractive as a thing to own. Like, and it's, is, I know it's mega shallow. I'm like, I'm the person rolling out to say, like, I'm playing a game I know is bad now because it's
but
pretty.
But it's not quite shallow because, like, for me, Magic Circle on the store page looks like it's not very well made. It looks like which a mess, is obviously the which is the point, which is, like, I mean, thematically, it totally makes sense. But, like, when you don't know much about a game and you want to you put down some money on it, you're like, worried that it's not going
to
work.
I think a best particular, it's an interesting problem because, you know, one of the, if you were going to try and develop a kind of, you know, sort of instinctive, a way of very quickly gauging the quality of a Steam game and knowing nothing about it just based on the sort of assets that are made available through the Steam store. Visual noise and complexity is actually a huge turnoff because most of the worst games on Steam are built out of assorted Unity store assets and look like work in progress sort of, you know, messes basically. And Magic Circle looks like that on purpose, which is clever and part of its high concept, but, and it's not to discredit the game because I haven't played, I shouldn't judgment on it. But weirdly, I think the aesthetic they've ended up going for is really close to bad Steam game, which is, you know, like, just deeply unfortunate. Whereas if you look at something like Firewatch, it's, you know, the, just visually, it has a really high quality.
Yeah, like, they've gone premium.
Yeah, like, yeah, it's...
The, did Jeff Bogle, like, that was an interesting one, because, like, did Jeff Bogle talk about what's happened in RPGs, like, over the course of the past 4 years or so, because he's been quietly making, so that like his business has been basically making a genre that no one else was paying any attention to. Like, you know, Baldur's Gate came and went for most of the like development world, and then he continued doing it, and there was a large hardcore of people who wanted more of that sort of thing that they weren't being served. But then, like, we've had loads of really sort of post Baldur's Gate sort of in-depth RPGs, you know, from that same staple that Jeff Bogle's been doing over the past, like, 3 years.
Huh. So you think they're kind of muscling
and
in there?
I wonder whether part of it for him is Pillars, like... Pillars of Eternity,
And, then, you know, so Obsidian just announced Tyranny, which is their new thing, which is sort of interesting partly because it feels like, this is a sequel you could have made to Baldur's Gate 20 years ago. Without anyone batting an eye, because that genre is simply "quote unquote" back now, but it was quietly not gone.
Yeah, it was completely out of fashion for ages. Yeah, like, you know, but he is extremely. Yeah, he's like, his interpretation of development and everything is cool. I'm surprised he didn't say anything about that.
Somebody asked a question after the talk about, do you guys think this is going to... A lot of the talks sort of concluded that this is like not, you know, it's not the end of indie games or anything. It's a dip or a, you know, recession or whatever. Well, that's the wrong word for it. And so someone asked him, Jeff, why, when he thought it would end. And he said, the beatings will continue till morale improves.
I mean, I genuinely hope the answer isn't to make every indie game into a kind of really well-crafted, kind of premium-feeling product that makes people kind of notice them above the crowd.
Yeah. I do think the sort of visual wow is one of the only reliable predictors of sales. I've never really seen, like, a sort of instantly gorgeous-looking game sell badly.
Yeah. Superhot would be a game I would also put forward as an example of really striking visually.
Yeah, that's interesting, because that's... that's a sort of art style that they maybe could have done for Magic Circle. It would make sense because it's primitive and it's kind of like unfinished. Well, not unfinished.
Like, you mean Superhot, this isn't a spoiler. You are explicitly within a unfinished piece of software.
Right. Okay.
Like, that is what the game is about. So,
Yeah, it's interesting.
Like, yeah, but you look at it and the presentation, it feels deliberate, right? Like, whereas the great enemy of green light is almost like accidental art, right? If you wanted to see, like, you know, the worst of green light or the worst of the sort of the bottom of the Steam, even the Steam store, is games that for whom art direction is a complete luxury, that there's a gameplay idea there, but it's realized through whatever assets the developer can legally get their hands on.
Mm.
And so maybe the way, you know, the audience is being trained to look for coherent art direction is a sign that something has had that extra bit of effort paid to it that makes it worth buying, as opposed to all the rest of the crap that Steam's algorithm is throwing at them.
And I'm totally aware that we're straying into the old kind of, you know, the Magic Circle would have done better if they'd just, you know, not lived up to the artistic vision they had. Like, and you know,
I'm saying is totally anecdotal.
Yeah.
It's just like it's funny. Like, I still want to play that game, but it's like whenever it comes to like I have, you know, I fancy buying a new game and I have a tenner to spend, the thing I come back, like, I do find it off-putting.
And you've also got Battlefront kind of pulling you in.
God, that's the most shameful. There's a worthy game I actually want to play, and I'm sat playing fucking Star Wars Lego. I'm an awful human being, and there's no excuse for that. But my awful instincts may reflect those of a broader audience.
Shall we do questions?
Yeah, go on then.
Alex writes, regarding your anecdote from playing a Division where you contemplated the likelihood of men named Alex being killed and the shocking numbers implied by NPC Brax bemoaning their loss, as a man named Alex, I can tell you right now that there are so many men with that name, the frequency of their murder in such a situation isn't entirely improbable. Thanks for listening, everybody. Alex.
Alex, as a Alex, a resident Alex, how do you feel about this matter?
I feel directly victimized.
By the Division?
By the Division. I don't know why they had to pick on one name. Or they had to know.
I think there are other names.
Why couldn't it be Chris?
Exactly. But I think there are other names, but they do shout, "They killed Alex!" a lot in that game.
I could it be just the one Alex, and he was really famous and really well liked?
I mean, he keeps dying.
Oh, they say it at
like
the
Oh, so yeah, it's one of the. It's like a random NPC combat bark. So when you kill an enemy, one of the other enemies might shout, "They killed Alex."
Maybe it just reminds him of the time that much more famous guy called Alex died.
Exactly. I mean, do you feel like the game is unfairly criminalizing Alexes?
I do, and like to think that Alex is a typical name for a hoodie. You know, I think that's unfair too.
You not feel like, you know, prone to looting stuff running around New York?
It would be attractive, I suppose.
See, all Alexes. All not, the same.
Hashtag not all Alexes. Starting right here. Yeah. Bollocks thing remains bollocks.
They could have, you know.
There are other names, I think, but, you know.
Just put a little kind of procedural generation into there. Like little. Oh no, they killed Graham.
Oh, no. I thought you were going to suggest they should try and procedurally generate like Anglo-Saxon names.
Ethelrude.
Oh my god, they killed Ethelrude.
Oh no, they killed Terence.
Oh my god, Staffan. Stuven, no.
Not Stuven.
It just sounds Swedish for some reason.
So there's one they missed.
Yeah. Oh no, not Brian.
Mr. G writes, hi, Coates and Codswallop. Now, despite the tiles, I love your podcast. Does he mean titles?
I think he must mean titles, yeah.
I'm sorry to see Tom and Graham go. I didn't know I was going.
See you then, Tom. I'm taking over.
Which Tom?
Is the other Tom going?
No. We kept both Toms. We just
used his Marsh has been forgotten.
He's so broken up about Marsh, he can't bring himself to say the name.
Written by
like Voldemort, he can't say the name. Ironically, Voldemort's real name is Tom.
So. Maybe that's who he's talking about. Yeah. Or Alex.
So we were all sorry to lose Voldemort.
But still look forward to it as my number one podcast. You are top in my auto playlist. on Beyond Podplayer. I guess that's a podcast player. My question to all journalists is, how can you make Reese a yourself, full RPG game in a modern setting and solve the problems better than The Division has? Tom Clancy's End War has is totally unrealistic as it's an RTS, but it is accepted that as an RTS, some concessions needed to be made. This is an RPG, so why not grant the same concessions? I wrote a load more, but the question above is the most important. Once you accept that this is an RPG game with a modern setting, and journos get over themselves, you can see how well they did it. Go back and play any third-person cover shooter to see just how good The Division plays, especially the AI, by comparison. If you want to see the ridiculousness of the reviews, simply change Tom Clancy / realism for fantasy and enemies for orcs, and tell me the points are still valid. What this shows is that the game is being criticized for nothing but a cheap shot at how this is unrealistic, a one-trick pony of a review strategy. The only problem is, the only problem it has that is that everything works so well and so smoothly, it looks like it's simple. And for the general populace, this is okay, but journalists should know better. This is not the crap Ubisoft have been pushing out the last few years, and they need to know that we get the quality of games again. We need to know that, so we get that quality of games again. Sorry, rant over. Keep up the great work, with the exception of The Division comments. Smiley face, Mr. G.
So, I guess we've all been journalists, so only I remain in the bucket of
the journalist bucket.
In the grinder.
So, there's a lot of stuff, and, you know, I appreciate the stuff we had to say about The Division, and us not liking The Division was not broadly agreed with. And, as I said at the time, I think The Division is a fine game, but no more than fine. There's a whole bunch of stuff raised there about, like, what the purpose of a review is and what a review should be. A review isn't a trick. And it's not a game, and it's not a ploy to get you to look at something. It's an assessment of a game based on what it is. And what The Division is a relatively traditional action MMORPG thing with a setting that absolutely fights the type of game it is at every corner. And of course the game would be fine if it was Orcs and Goblins and Fantasy instead. That's the point. But they didn't make that game. They made Hoodies in New York with health bars that take 50 clips of ammunition to down. They made a game whose underlying structures and systems are actively discordant with the fiction that they've also invested a lot of money into realizing. There's no arguing that The Division isn't interested in its story, because it has cutscenes, it has unlockable videos that are designed to tell you the fiction as you progress, it has audio diaries, it has all of this stuff, it has a story.
And the setting is so kind of sharply drawn, like that New York is amazing.
It's, you know, they've invested, the best thing about the game is that setting.
Mm.
Like, that city is beautifully realized. It looks great. It is a good shooter. I wouldn't agree that it's a best-in-class third-person shooter. I think there are better. But, like, it's, you know, it's good. It's solid. But then the RPG thing rolls along. And the question, well, if you're not, how do you do it better than this, is sort of the wrong one. Because the question is, what you're essentially asking is, like, well, this, you know, how do you tilt more effectively at a windmill? Like, their objective is weird. Like, the question, how do you make a kind of traditional looting action RPG work in a setting where the reported, you know, the atmosphere is like grim survival and your enemies are real people and it's in a license which is known for, among other things, its lethality? Like, if you wanted to draw a connection between all the different Clancy games, Shoot Man and Headman Falls Down is probably one of them, regardless of whether that's Splinter Cell or Rainbow Six or something like that. All of those things mean this isn't the game you make in that concept, in that context. Because it's weird. I don't know if, like, because, I mean, Alex, you've played The Division, right? Like,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, I think the setting totally fights the game design. Like, I mean, I like you, Chris, I played a lot of Destiny, and there's a lot of Destiny, as everyone knows, in Division. And I remember when Destiny came out and the bullet sponge bosses were a point of some contention, but not as much as it feels here, because the Destiny theme kind of support, there's enough fantasy in there to support you're like this insanely powerful,
a big space skeleton with a laser gun, like you can, there's room there.
It doesn't make sense, but you can make it make sense, you know. But in Clancy Land, I, you know, it's a, like you said, like it's a in Clancy Land things drop with a headshot.
Yeah, like, and there's a question like, well, if you're going to make a Clancy RPG, how do you do it better than this? And fair enough, maybe you can't do it better than this. The question should be, why would you make a Clancy RPG? Not every genre is going to be suitable for every setting. You know, you probably are not going to make a Tom Clancy card battler, right? Like, they're not going to announce, like, you know, Clancy Stone, the game where, you know...
Hearth Clancy.
Yeah, Hearth Clancy. They're probably not going to make Hearth Clancy, the game where you play various energy costs in order to deploy Rainbow Six operatives to counter your opponent's Rainbow Six operatives on a board. Because no one would see that and go, all right, this is a meaningful recreation of a fiction or a fictional universe that I enjoy, right? It's just not, you know, it's too far removed. You can do that with Warcraft because it's these big, larger-than-life characters that have really clear interactions with each other and so on. Clancy's not really about that. And I think, you know, in to a less extreme degree, the same applies to The Division. Like, it's just not a good fit for the fiction. And not only is it not good, simply because Clancy is rooted in real life, the fiction there goes beyond simply this particular fictional universe, which might be my problem with Battlefront, and into this set of RPG systems is not a good fit for a game set in the real world 2 weeks in the future where everyone's fighting each other with scrounged, you know, scavenged AK-47s.
And it doesn't, and it does feel, I mean, did you read that kill screen feature about the...
I did not get through it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that it was pretty on the nose about a lot of things, about sort of some of the, you know, when you've got a bunch of hoodies attacking and some of the meanings behind all that. You know, it's where the setting is really fighting the theme badly.
Like, yeah, it's simply not a good use of that. Like, I'd like to play a shooting RPG set in that world, but it, you know, we said in the last podcast, like, it's one of those things where you don't want them to cop out of their high concept, but the moment fucking aliens show up in The Division, it would just save it. You know what I mean? Like, it would just allow it to be a game, because it's doing that sort of deadpan thing of it's, you know, this could really happen. What if money was evil? Kind of.
Imagine. Thing.
Yeah. But it's just the wrong fit.
Like, there's also some really retrograde stuff in it. Sort of, you know, I find I haven't been... I played maybe two nights of it. I actually really enjoyed it. You know, like, setting a lot of, you know, what we were discussing aside, you know, I enjoyed running about and doing stuff. But now the friends that I was playing with, they've been playing more than me, and now they've leveled out of my range. And like, come on, not again, not still. I've been in this situation so many times. Everybody has. Like, surely they could have spent some time just thinking about the RPG system if they're not going to, you know.
I think it's interesting because I think for both quote-unquote sides in this, like, because, I know I didn't write the PC Game review, but I agree with it. And I wrote something subsequently about the game on PC Game with the realisted, this listener has been really super polite, and I appreciate that, but we've had a lot of people tell us that we're shits and should die over just simply not liking the game. Which is, you know, par for the course. But, like, it's not a grand conspiracy when a bunch of different journalists agree on what the flaws of a game are. That's not, like, a conspiracy to find an angle that will be the most controversial. It's often just that people who spend a lot of time looking at games for review will often sometimes come to a consensus about what the common flaws are.
And discover you don't have anything invested in it as well.
What do you mean?
You know, like...
Well, yeah, we're not necessarily bound to like it by the fact that we made an investment in it. Exactly. That's part of it, yeah. But there are also, I think, you know, real deep material flaws with it. Like, it doesn't have a proper endgame yet. It doesn't have... doesn't really seem to have scope to develop a particularly interesting one. Like, Destiny's the best example. Destiny gained Vault of Glass, which we played together for the first time, Alex. Like, you were in that initial exploring party that we went into with. Mm. It gained that a few weeks after release, and that, I think, was one of the best game experiences I had in the last couple of years, like, discovering that series of encounters for the first time. I'm genuinely not sure, just on a material level, how The Division achieves anything like that.
I mean, maybe you'll get to go into a sewer and follow some sewers through some tubes and then come up to a guy in it.
Yeah. Like, maybe, you know, we'll shoot a different hoodie. Like, it's not going to be a time hoodie, is it? Like, you're not going to stand on... You're not going to be, like, rescuing your friends from the alternate dimension that they've been cast into by the fucking
Time Hoodie.
Time Hoodie, are they? No, because that would be nonsense within the Clancy thing. And yeah, but I think actually, weirdly, the fight over the setting, which, you know, we totally dug into deep on the last podcast, has ended up distracting from probably what should be the discussion of that game's more serious issues with, for example, allowing friends to play with each other, which I know Tom really struggled with. And the fact that, like, if I was to jump onto it today, say, there's no reasonable way for me to play with any of my friends. You know, if I was just starting today, there'd be no reasonable way for me to play with anybody who'd been playing it for more than a couple of days, because there's just no provision for that. And those things are just flat out failings, regardless of whether or not it would be better with orcs.
Hafaz writes, hello, the Crate of Wine Bar. I'm hopelessly addicted to the metagame of Steam achievements. I'm one of the 1% who get all of them for some games. This can be sometimes silly. Civ 5 has 287 of the wretched things. On reflection, I do this for two reasons. One, making numbers go up is the foundation of most games anyway. Two, I like some of the novel challenges thrown up when trying to get multiple achievements at once. E.g. in XCOM 2, trying to complete the game in 4 months but with only four soldiers. Are any of you similarly affected by completionitis? What's the most satisfying achievement you've got? I went on a quest to get the achievement in Half-Life 2 Episode 1 that involves taking a garden gnome from the very first location of the game to the very end of the game and putting him in a shuttle that then sends him into space. And I was reviewing it, so I didn't do it then. And in fact, I think I didn't even see the achievements list until either after I played or midway through when I was playing. And as soon as I like saw that achievement and realized what it was asking me to do, I knew that would be my next playthrough. It was just doing that. And it was a whole epic journey. It's a, like, the game is simultaneously not designed to allow this. Like, it's just a irritating physics thing that there's driving sections, right? And there's no place to kind of put the gnome securely in the car. It'll always fall out. And there's time driving sections where you're being attacked by a helicopter that both drops bombs in front of you and shoots you with a minigun. And the gnome falling out during that means you've got to actually like park while you're being shot at, get out, pick him up and put him back in the passenger seat and drive off again. And so it's like simultaneously the systems of the game are horribly ill-suited to this, and yet the fact that it's possible yet difficult makes it, you know, an enjoyable challenge.
It shows that it's possible is enough.
Yeah, it's just
also it's called Noam Chomsky, which is the best.
Yeah. I think the achievement is called Noam Little Chomsky. Rocket Man, but yeah, yes. Noam is called that. And then there's another one in, I think, Left 4 Dead.
Yeah, where it's called Noam Chomsky.
Yes, very good. That one was fun, actually. We... because obviously it's a co-op game, so there's four of you, and in that there is a sort of special system for carrying the gnome. You sort of, you know, you pick it up, and there's an animation, I guess, for you holding the gnome,
yeah.
And you can't use any weapons while you're holding it, so other people have to cover you, and of course the other people aren't necessarily as invested in your quest as you are. And yeah, that was fun. We had it was the campaign where it ends in like a big rock concert, and.
Don't you have to win the gnome as well? Don't you have to do well at the random
shooting? Oh, yeah, you win it at a fairground, so you have to shoot some stuff. And then we had a horrible finale where loads of people died, but I got out with the gnome, so it's fine. Any of you have particular achievements that were good to get?
I'm not very good at these things. Like, achievements lists make me feel profoundly depressed because I know that I won't get any of them.
I had a weird, I used to be kind of, when I used to do most of my game playing on Xbox, I used to care about achievements, and I would consider getting 100% of the achievements in a game like a little nod to the developer. Like, if I could do it, it'd be like, I liked your game. And rather than give you any extra money for it, this is kind of how I express that. So, like, or if I really cared about a game, I'd feel like it was a matter of pride that I had all the achievements in it. So I did it for Bioshock 1 and 2 and both Mass Effect 1 and 2 as well. Mass Effect 1 and 2 is a total fucking asshole to do. Because
Mass Effect 2, I can't remember what I'm trying to do actually.
Mass Effect 2 is easier. Mass Effect 1 has achievements for completing the majority of the game with a particular squad member, and it has one of those achievements for every squad member. And the majority of the game is determined as like 2/3 of all the missions, including side missions. So the like the minimum you can do it in is like 3 playthroughs if you're clever. And like so that's an ass, that's just a pain in the ass to do. Did it, don't know why. But like it was interesting speaking of XCOM, like recently, like I went and looked at the achievements list because I'd gotten a I wanted to see, like, given that I'm now doing this, you know, victory lap thing, how many people have gotten, you know, the continent bonus, every continent bonus in a single playthrough kind of thing. And those things get quite small, but actually one thing that really impressed me is like Steam shows you like the percentage of people who've gotten each achievement. The amount of people who've made serious progress in that campaign who've played it is actually really high. Like there are, I'm not going to spoil anything, but there are like, you know, there are achievements for like do this particular research thing that you can only do after you've encountered a thing that's related to the story. And like most of those are like 60-70% even for the late game.
That's
and like
remarkable.
Yeah, like given the type of game that it is, given that it's hard, a lot of people seem to be like who buy it and play it seem to get to that point. I don't know exactly how that's measured and how accurate it is, but it seems pretty striking to me.
Sam Barlow is saying that something like, oh, I'm going to forget the percentage now, but I can correct it in the show notes. Something like 25% of people have the achievement for getting for seeing every single clip in her story, which is remarkable. Because I probably have seen them all, but I did it by just opening up the game files and watching them. Like past a certain point, it's really hard to find like the last couple because you've already searched for everything you can think of, and you've got to find the word that's unique to those last clips. Without, you know, early on, that's something significant. It's like a plot revelation. You think of the theme, and then you find some cool stuff, but once you've gone through like 90% of them, the things that are only mentioned in those clips are going to be something that there's no way to kind of get a lead on it. Something about achievements I was going to say. Oh yeah, the Steam community has like an activity feed for your friends that tells you like when they buy a game, but also when they earn an achievement in the game, and if they share a screenshot. That really feels like kind of the best use of achievements. It feels like what achievements are for, even though it's not like traditionally designed for. It's so great just to like see, if it's a game I know, it's great to see, oh, like, you know, that's kind of how I noticed that John Roberts was really into Flame and the Flood, because I was looking at my Steam activity feed and saw he had all these achievements for, you know, having defeated a wolf and having defeated a boar or something. And just telling you like a little bit about what's in the game and what the person's done is really intriguing. And if you haven't played it, then it's, you know, a great thing to like advertise the game as well. You know, you see someone's playing something that's got an achievement, something that sounds completely absurd, and you kind of want to check it out.
Yeah, it's interesting because it kind of, that goes back to like your advice to how to describe a game to people in a way. It's because it focuses on actions. Like it doesn't just, it's not like you don't get an achievement for like appreciated our backstory. Like, it's always like, you know, tricked an enemy into doing this, or defeated 3 enemies in 10 seconds or something. Like,
it's also kind of got me thinking about what I want to do for, you know, achievements in my games, because it's sometimes you want to give them for things that are good to do, so that you sort of use achievements like a tutorial and say, hey, this is a, you should try this. But then sometimes you also want to acknowledge failure. Like, it's funny if you die in a ridiculous way and you get an achievement for like, well done, you died in a ridiculous way. And so I started to think of it more as like, not what do you want to reward, but what do you want to expose about your game to the external world? Because everyone can see this list of achievements. You can hide them if you want, but most of them you're going to expose. So it's like, when someone does this thing, do you want their friends to be able to see that in their Steam activity feed? And, you know, that obviously suggests a whole bunch of like a kind of a different philosophy of what should be achieved. It's just like nutty things or things that really give you an idea of what the character of the game is and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Andrew writes, "Dear Crate Apes, why did people like the Overwatch short so much? I tried searching online, but couldn't find a single bad word about it, which I found maddening. I understand that the animation is superbly high quality, but surely other qualities should be required. I thought it was generic, cliched, and had all the emotional impact of a no-win, no-fee advert. Splanker de Fiblin, Bibli Bobby."
So we should probably explain. So I think today, as the time of recording, a couple of days ago, as the time you're listening to this, Blizzard put out the first of what they've said will be the Overwatch short films. We actually spoke about this in the last podcast, where we talked about how maybe stiff their challenges to do better than Valve and the TF2 movies. And I 100% agree with this guy. I think the thing they've released is really technically impressive, but in no meaningful way exceeds what has been done like 9 times in a row by Valve now.
Very, very empty.
Yeah.
He doesn't... How much... I haven't played Overwatch. How much of it implies the characters, the apes' abilities in-game?
Well... So, you know, so the plot of the short film, you know.
Is it called Ape Out?
It's not.
I want it to be a phrase.
He does have a line where he goes, "I'm not a monkey."
He did.
I'm a scientist.
Yeah.
But he's actually a gorilla. So I thought the line was going to be, "I'm not a monkey. I'm a gorilla," because that's what he is. But
it was a joke.
It was a joke. Yeah.
It was a really, yeah.
It was Bantz. But like, so, go and watch it now. Pause the podcast and go and watch it if you don't want spoilers. But like, so it's about one of the characters, Winston, who's a gorilla, scientist, moon gorilla thing. And you do see, over the course of that video, all of his abilities in the game.
Right.
Because his lightning gun that he uses at the end, that's his standard weapon.
But that lightning, doesn't he take that weapon from his attackers?
No, he picks it up. It's his own gear.
Oh, okay.
Because he's not wearing his armor. His armor's like hanging up at the start, and then at the end you see him, he's wearing. And then he leaps, which is one of his things. He does his rage out.
Yeah.
Ape out.
He apes out, like people say. And and the shield thing that in the movie, he has this like malfunctioning shield dome thing he's explaining with. In the game, he has that as a full dome shield that's much, much bigger and works. So the implication is that he's designing it or something. But... you know, it's a super simplistic. It's like
they're trying to do like a full Pixar kind of character arc in 5 minutes. It's sort of so
well. They're trying to do one of those Pixar shorts. Like Pixar do shorts, right? Yeah. Like
they're trying to do they want to give you origin. They want to give you emotional drive. They want to give you payoff, and they want to give you kind of a jumping off point for, you know, like,
and action. And,
it's just. It's just so clipped and so trite. Oh. Mm.
And it's really without wit, which is one of the things that struck me about it.
Well, there's no room for wit. It's got to do all the other things.
But, like, you know, consider that... So Overwatch doesn't have classes, it has characters. So the task that, like, Valve had with TF2 is slightly different. In TF2, they had to invest personality into something that by default is just heavy or medic or something like that. Whereas this, they have a big gorilla in a spacesuit called Winston, and immediately you've got more of a personality there on paper. But they've gone in the opposite direction, because they've kind of gone in the sort of backstory direction, and you're expected to care about stuff. And I love Overwatch. Like, I think it's a brilliant game. Like, I'm really excited about it. And I was excited for this. But it simply doesn't... I don't know, I agree with you. Like, it doesn't seem to have any kind of... like, sort of narrative thrust to it. There's no sort of, like, ooh, yeah, wit or drive. It's trying to do everything at once, from explaining where this guy comes from to making
it feels like it. It feels like it's gone through that Hollywood kind of script writing school where, okay, we've got three-act structure, we've got to do this here, and then this has to go here. It's like, it looks like it's been tuned to kind of optimals. I watched it with my son, who's 10, and, like, he loved it, absolutely loved it, because I think that's, like, in true Blizzard fashion... that's where they're squarely looking, you know.
Maybe.
I think
it's not an appropriate game for them, though. Like,
probably not. No.
No, I mean, it's not in terms of subject matter, but it's a complex multiplayer competitive game, right?
Like, yeah. But like, Blizzard is hyper mass market. That's what they do. They take stuff from elsewhere, they twist it into their thing, and make it and package it for the mass. You know. And that's what they do.
It feels very calculated in some ways, because
absolutely,
like, so there's a bit at the end where it does like this sort of you know, Overwatch is activated, this sort of international organization, and it does this sort of like you see like a whole bunch of like headshots of Overwatch agents flicker past on the screen, and within minutes of the trailer going live, you know, Overwatch Reddit had been through it frame by frame to find who we currently know about and who might be characters they haven't added to the game yet, and cross-referenced it with old concept art. And that's super deliberate in a way that pisses me off a little bit, because I was there at BlizzCon doing the interviews where they said, no, this is a 21 character game. We are launching with 21 characters. They are our characters, whatever. And everyone thought they'd do more characters after the fact. But now that they're actively teasing it before the games are even out, it feels like, not backtracking necessarily, but it's that kind of showmanshipy kind of...
Oh, wink, wink. They know
when they put that in there what the community will do. Yeah. If they try and feign surprise that, oh, you guys thought that was like an extra 12 characters that we hadn't announced? Oh, what a surprise. We didn't think you'd do that. Like, that's complete bollocks. They must know that that's how doing something like that in the trailer
will... And actually, Valve do that with the TF2 shorts. Like, early on, there was... they noticed people sort of searching every frame for little details and stuff. And then they started intentionally putting clues in. And then they found that people would, as well as detecting all of the clues they put in, they would just read in clues that weren't there. Like the there was a mechanical hand hanging up in one of the videos. And it was actually to tease, I think, the bots they were adding for co-op mode. But people thought it was a mechanical hand for the engineer. So they added a mechanical hand for the engineer. Because they've reasoned like, well, everyone really wants this thing and they're really excited about it. We should actually do that.
Yeah.
But that just shows that it, like, you know, where the... TF2 setup, you know, all of the shorts are partly just making fun of the fact that, like, this is a game that really doesn't need any kind of story or theme, and it's just madness to even try to do that. So let's put an insanely detailed story about all these
characters. Exactly. And, like, it's really striking to me, like, how good, like, you know, people got really excited when those new TF2 class movies came out because they're all individually really, really funny. Like, they're really sharp, and this... is an opportunity to do that that has been roundly missed, I think. Like, it's sort of, you know, it is mass marketing, kind of exciting and stuff. And I don't know necessarily that Overwatch is the vehicle for subversive humor that Team Fortress became, because it is sort of larger than life, and that's fine. I think more to the point, it's not good fiction of the type it's actually trying to be. Maybe it's unfair to say it's not good satirical bizarro world action comedy that Team Fortress is, but, like, for me, it really feels like the video, the expensive looking video version of the tie-in comic you get with the collector's edition of a game,
with an extra sort of layer of mawkish sort of,
but it always has, like, backstory you don't give a shit about, and you know what I mean, like, that kind of, it's a story about a man who wants to do a thing, and then he doesn't really do the thing, but then he has a fight, and then he does the thing. And then video game, right? Like, I've read that story a lot.
Henry writes, best armor set in video games. From a visual standpoint, of course. I rather like Dragon Age Inquisition's Trespasser DLC rogue set. Possibly because he said Dragon Age, all I can think of is the armor set in Dragon Age 2 that's kind of the, sort of the signature one for the main character that has this kind of, like, pointed, rigid plate that sticks up from the press plate, like in front of your neck. I guess a neck guard might be the word for that. And I always really like the look of that. I think it might even have several, like, sort of...
It has spiky shoulder pads and a huge fur collar as well.
Yeah.
Always
big fan of fur collars.
It's the best wizard armor in a game.
I recently finished, finally finished Witcher 3, and the Griffin set, Witcher set, is a... Oh, it's beautiful armor. you've got tassels on the shoulders that flop around. Lovely.
Pretty good.
You've got some spiky bits in the shoulders. Lovely. You've got a lovely leathery sheen on it. Lovely. That's really nice. It's green, but with gold kind of detailing. Lovely. you've got a little flappy, chainmail.
Both flappy back. And tassely. Oh, yeah.
Like this stuff moves. The legs fit really nicely. Like, you know, like he looks good in it. Like up front, up the top, he's kind of quite broad. The legs looks live. I think it's my favorite of all time.
Really shows off his gams.
He's got the best guns as well.
Gam highlighting Griffin armor. I remember even, like, the starting chainmail set in that, the sort of the rendering effect on the chainmail is really neat. It kind of, like, chainmail is usually this kind of, like, rough and dirty armor, but it makes it look really smart.
But in this as well, like, if it's hanging, they've actually made it so it's physics as well, so it flops.
It's physics. Well.
Made it so it's physics.
It's physics.
This armor is physics. 10 gold.
Come on, Chris, what's yours?
Oh,
God. You must have one. There are good ones in Mass Effect, but I can't remember any of them.
Like, because Mass Effect's kind of about, like, piecing together your own, really. Like, Mass Effect 1 had the problem, well, where you'd just wear whatever you found. And so, like, I ended the game wearing black and pink stripey armor. The others are all about, you know, N7 stuff. And it is just variants on plate it's, and lights.
They're not awfully exciting.
There was a terrible Dragon Age set.
Yeah, it was awful. Yeah, yeah, it was all spiky.
Like,
yeah.
they tried to play it like it was the sports armor for future sports for a team called the Edmonton Blood Dragons. Which is not the most fucking subtle attempt to point out that, yes, BioWare Edmonton did make Dragon Age. And yes, the game has blood and dragons in it. That, I mean, in terms of, like, we're fucking, like, we're going for it, like, you know, pre-order tie-in stuff, fine. I don't know.
I do remember, like, really fine-tuning my armor, I think, in Mass Effect 3, where you sort of choose individual, like, leg plates and stuff. And finding the right color for them and sort of, well, there was some kind of, like, matte black effect that I really liked.
Yeah.
And then you could also... There were some, like, helmets or sort of masks, and there's one that's just, like, a kind of full like, cloth mask, I guess, with these, like, white goggles, and it looks nuts. But I meticulously, like, put that on any time that my character was going into space.
Tell you what, it's not a PC game, but Destiny has some gorgeous, really, really, really nice, like, great use of fabrics, great use of interesting detailing, fabulous visual design across the board, really, you know, beautifully graphic designed, you know, decals. Oh,
yeah, it's bracing. Armor.
The Daedric armor in Morrowind was pretty cool. It's been in, I think, probably every Elder Scrolls game. It's like the best kind, just objectively. But the cool thing about Morrowind was that I think there was only one complete set in the whole game, and it was just scattered all over the place. And so, like, there was a wizard in the Telvanni capital who had the only, like, left shin piece for this. Or maybe it was left pauldron or something. And so you had to get it from him. And then most of the other pieces, there might be, like, two copies of them somewhere. And then I think... I'm pretty sure that there are many different Daedric helmets, but all of them are different. They all have a different face on them, and they're, like, they represent the different Daedric gods, and they would have different unique bonuses and stuff.
How'd they drop that with... Oblivion, because I really hated the set in the Daedric set in Oblivion, and you had to have it because it was like by far there was no reason not to have it other than the fact that it was horrible looking.
I have a feeling they still had the mask thing, like there were different helmets you could get for
that. It comes back in Skyrim as the Dragon Priest masks,
right?
Where they're all different names and they all have slightly different looks.
One of the things I liked about the Witcher armor was that, like, I wore Griffin because I liked the look of it. All of the armor, it does confer various kind of status effects and kind of things, but the improvements aren't so strong that you can't make a sort of an aesthetic decision.
Right,
and that's good. And they are all very, very, very different. So you can just look, and there are loads of different kinds of clothes. And, but also to get the top layer, like the best Witcher sets of armor, takes quite a lot of work. You've got to kind of go and find the plans to get them. You've got to craft them. You've got to level up the craftsman in order to be able to do it. Like, it's a real sense of kind of achievement as well, which, yeah, it's nice.
Yeah, I think allowing people to invest loads of time in making something that they like the look of is probably often more important than letting them make some, like, stats aren't that. No one cares about stats.
Stats are boring. And also, like, stats steer you. Like, you're kind of having to... You kind of acquiesce to the aesthetic decisions simply because they have the functionality.
Yeah, that sucks.
Dragon Age Inquisition did a good change where, in that game where you craft armor, because most of it's crafting rather than looting, when you craft armor, it's quite detailed. Like, the materials you're using for metal, leather, cloth directly affect the color. And you can you can fiddle with things, but... Like, dragon bone is one of the best materials in that game, and it's white, or kind of like off-white bone color. And so the best, you're going to kind of skew towards wearing white armor as you get higher level. And then they changed it so that you can choose what material you're using for the actual quality of the item and then supplement a different material as the aesthetic one.
Like a veneer.
So it's like, this is dragon bone, but with like a bronze veneer or something.
Imagine being so rich that you want to hide the fact your armor is made of dragon bone. I don't want to see the dragon bone. Oh, I want to see pure crystal.
It's too showy.
but it's quite a nice choice because it doesn't completely, it's not like something like transmogrification where you swap the look of one item sort of artificially for the look of another.
Which in it's Diablo sort of involved, 3 is like, it feels wrong.
It feels fake when you do it. You feel like you've violated one of the prime tenets of that game, which is I will get spikier over time. God damn
it. I just checked, and the Gabe Cruzeiro's game is called Ape Out.
Ape Out. Okay,
that's where I know that phrase from, because it's the actual name of the game.
Ape Out.
I thought that was a term.
The ape is out.
Yeah, the ape does get out, so it's hard to argue with.
That is it. That is literally
it. Does sound like what you call a game if you'd forgotten the phrase "go ape."
He's aping out over there.
Maybe "go ape" is taken.
Yeah, maybe it is. Yeah,
like copyright issues. That is all the questions we've got time for.
If you'd like to send us a question for a future episode of the podcast, you can do so by emailing questions@creightoncrowbar.com. Alternatively, you can tweet us at Creighton Crowbar. You can leave a question on the forum at creightoncrowbar.com/forum and discuss the episode on Discord, which is where our community tends to hang out. You can find Discord details either in the show notes for this episode, more than likely, or on the sidebar of the website at creightoncrowbar.com. If you'd like to follow or tweet us individually, you may do so. Tom is
at Pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
Alex is
Rotational. Do I need to spell it?
Probably don't need to spell that.
Like rotation with owl at the end.
Yeah, rotation owl.
Rotation owl, they call him.
Is that what it comes from? You used to rotate a lot as a kid, and like people were just like, oh, that's old owl.
Rotating owl.
Oh, no, they shot a rotating owl.
I've genuinely never thought about that before.
Rotating owl Wiltshire there with his futile objections to his new nickname.
Everyone will remember your Twitter name now.
Even I will.
And I'm C Thurston, which is CTHURSTEN. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Goodbye.
Spot the new guy.